Okay, well, welcome, dear listeners, to another edition of the Jacobs Podcast. Today we're talking Warren Buffett, or Buffettology, and joining me to talk about Warren Buffett is WID Capital's Jordan Shopov. Jordan, welcome to the podcast.
G'day, Sean. Great to be with you again. I'm super excited for this one.
Likewise, I know you'd be super excited about this because, among Adam Smith and a few other, Charlie Munger, I know Warren Buffett is one of your heroes and you know him back to front. And I thought it'd be a great chance to introduce some of that knowledge on him to a wider audience. And I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, I mean, my wife's getting a bit sick of me talking about him, so if I can offload it onto someone else, she'll be very appreciative as well.
Fair enough. Well, I'm sure listeners will appreciate that. Excellent. So we just were sort of talking a little bit before we got on, and sort of leave no stone unturned is the approach, because you do seem to, every time we check in, sort of every few days or a few weeks, you seem to be learning something new from Warren Buffett. And it is quite impressive because you're someone who's certainly read the most on him that I am aware of, definitely. For listeners who probably have a very, I think most listeners will know who Warren Buffett is, but maybe just a quick primer on who he is, what he's done, and kind of where he's come from. I think it'd be a really good place to start.
Okay, let's see how I go with that. He's probably obviously the most well known for his wealth. So, either richest man in the world or one of the richest for a number of years now. And I'll be honest, that's how I first came across him. I think anyone who says that's not how they came across him is kidding themselves. It's like you get interested in Warren Buffett because you want to know how to make money. So that was how I got interested in him. And then it was about learning about his investing track record, what he's done in the world of business, and he has a very interesting story in the sense that he's not like a traditional Wall Street banker or anything like that. He's from Omaha, Nebraska, which is the Midwest of the United States. He was born in 1930, very or probably upper middle class family, and going through his story, I mean, I've read the definitive biography of him, which is called Snowball by Elise Schroeder, and it tracks his life and where he gets interested in business from a very young age. And we can get into the minutiae of some of this stuff later on, but he's essentially, hence the title of the book Snowball, he started compounding money at a very, very young age, and it's just kept rolling and rolling. But in the process, he's become not only renowned for the wealth, but his philanthropy, and also I think his character. Like, he's one of the most respected people in business ever. There's plenty of other rich people, but no one, I think, with his level of integrity that or respect among all quarters. Like, no one, have you ever heard anyone say a bad thing about him? It's very hard to find. But maybe I can throw this back on you, Sean, because it's like there's so much I can talk about. It's like, what do you think of when you hear Warren Buffett? What comes to mind? What are the ways you can think of him?
Yeah, look, I think probably obviously wealth, is one. The other thing, of course, is motivation. Like a lot of YouTube videos have principles and tips and advice like around motivation, always have something from Warren Buffett, especially if they're around wealth. I think I sent one to you the other day, about, so it's sort of, I guess, that plus character and also humility. I think that was one of the first things I learned or I heard about Buffett. Like up there, he's up there with the founder of IKEA, whose name escapes me, but one of those sort of famous, very wealthy people who also lives a very humbled lifestyle. And I remember watching a doco a few years ago on Buffett where, he gets the he's driving a very, like a very basic car to work, takes the same route, stops in, get a Mac, gets a Macca's coffee from the drive-through.
The sausage
Yeah, and
McMuffin.
that's it. From whatever you can glean from him, it's not put on for show. It seems he's a very humbled kind of character, despite amassing huge wealth that, I think is obviously in the hundreds of billions of dollars, I presume.
Yeah, or if he, I think he's, I don't know what his net worth figure is at the moment. It's in the billions, obviously, but it would be much higher if it still included the amount he's already given away to charity. So his plan at the moment is to give away 99% to various foundations, mainly the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which itself is pretty massive, a massive undertaking. But yeah, he is, the numbers are astronomical. But you said something there which resonated with me, which was about humility. Like, I think the more I dug into his life, and once you get past, you know, his investing philosophy and business philosophy, and you start to learn more about the man behind the figures, you see that, yeah, there is a very down-to-earth person who's doesn't seem to be caught by the trappings of wealth. And it's also like the wealth is almost like a byproduct of him sticking to his values. It's like his personal values are completely aligned with the way he lives his life. And so not only is he sort of the wealthiest man in the world, you start to realize that he's probably the most content as well. And it's got nothing to do with the money. It's like his bank balance could be zero and he'd still be pretty happy. It's like he's found something that he loves to do. He's stuck to it. And there's a concept he talks about, or not him, but his biographer talks about, which is the inner scorecard. So apparently Buffett got this from his father at a young age. Which was this idea of living your life according to your values, according to your own scorecard, and not worrying about what other people, what other people's expectations are of you. It's really kind of defining what you think your mission, your purpose, your character should be, and then living according to those values. And the great question he asks people to kind of typify this inner scorecard, outer scorecard is like, would you prefer to be the best lover in the world, but have everyone think you're the worst? Or be the worst lover in the world and have it best? And the idea is like, you know, obviously the best lover in the world, but everyone to think you're the worst, because that's how you get that sort of the personal satisfaction, personal, you know, that fulfillment about you're doing the right thing. And that's, I think he does that, yeah, to a T.
Yeah. So. Yeah, fair enough. And I remember that he actually found what he had an affinity for. You know, I guess he had, like, maybe he didn't find his inner scorecard initially, but from what I understand, he was, you know, started devouring books from a really young age. And, you know, by when he was 8, he'd read every book in the library of his local library. So he's able to sort of maybe not get an inner scorecard, but it seems that he was sort of fortunate in the sense that he pounced on knowledge and came across that very early. And then I guess moved into being able to, you know, look through balance sheets of companies and kind of found his way there. But that's I think, a really good point about that inner scorecard, because it's kind of like but to get to know that, you need to sort of work out yourself. And it's sort of something that probably a lot of young people need to take time working that out, I suppose. It's not something that's sort of easily accessible, because, you know, I think a lot of adults I know haven't found their inner scorecard, but it's sort of, I sort of sense that he was kind of fortunate in those early years to be able to find that. But I think one of the things he says is, you know, great role models can assist in that process. And like you mentioned, his father, but is there anyone else that he kind of looked up to that you think, Jordan?
There's definitely a few, but I think it's worth touching on his father for a bit longer. Cause I think reading his biography, Warren's father is probably the biggest unsung hero of his story or of his entire life. Because, like, as you mentioned, he was reading books on investing at like 8 years old. I think he bought his first stock at 11. Mm. And, you know, he was starting businesses in his teens. It was like, you know, this guy really was a prodigy. It's like if you think you can replicate Warren Buffett, you know, unless you were buying stocks at age 11, you're not there. Just give up now. So, but his old man was a congressman for a while, and he actually made a name for himself because he was completely out of whack with the Republican Party's policy positions. He kind of just played by his own tune, hence the inner scorecard. Mm. It was, but he was a very traditional conservative, and he had it 2 or 3 terms, I think, in Congress, and then outside of that, he was a stockbroker. So I think being around his old man, idolizing his old man, he, you know, got a taste for stocks at a very young age. And, yeah, he, that, I think he still has a photo of his, sorry, not a photo, like a portrait of his old man in his office today. And I think, yeah, he took a lot of confidence out of the way his old man treated him and supported him and, you know, kind of gave him every opportunity to pursue his interests. And it just, yeah, flourished. Yeah. But then if you want to talk about other role models, definitely Benjamin Graham. Have you heard of him?
Yeah, yeah, I had.
So obviously he was a father of value investing. You know, he wrote two of the most important books on investing ever written, which was The Intelligent Investor and Security Analysis. Two books which are still considered the best things you can read if you want to become a good investor today. And
I remember the latter one. I remember our time in Canberra. You were never seen without having Security Analysis within arm's reach or at least 5 meters. It was a tattered copy, but you carried it everywhere. And yeah. I remember us asking, what is that? Like, and you were launched into a, you know, presentation on Benjamin Graham. But now I appreciate it a lot more.
Yeah, that was probably a sign that I was in the wrong place, walking around a government with Intelligent Investor.
Wow, that's why everyone was so confused. But
yeah, that I lasted even 12 months. Yeah. Yeah, and I was only carrying that because Security Analysis was too heavy to carry around. Otherwise, it would have been that.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ben Graham was actually Buffett's teacher, and so I think Buffett talks about as a young age, he was like doing all sorts of crazy stuff like charting and technical analysis and, you know, reading the tea leaves. He would have tried anything to you know, make money out of stocks. That was, you know, that was just his approach because he was still trying to find his like intellectual rudder, so to speak. Cool. And then he ended up reading, I think he said he read The Intelligent Investor, and that was kind of like a light bulb went off. It was like, okay, this makes sense. This is how I should be approaching it. And then he ended up, he wanted to get into Harvard, I think, Harvard Business School, and didn't get in. He got knocked back, which I'm sure Harvard's still ruining. Mm. And then, he ended up looking around.
Well, I think they knocked back Jack Barr as well, just quickly, or someone like that. I mean, they've got a famous record, I think, of knocking back successful people, but obviously take on a lot more, but that's a brief aside.
Yeah. Maybe if you, I guess you can balance it out with Gates. Yeah. That's fair. But yeah, he got knocked back from Harvard, was looking at other business schools, ended up looking at Columbia and saw that Ben Graham was a teacher there. And apparently he sent a letter to the school saying, "Oh my God, I thought you were dead. I read your book. Can I come and study under you?"
Wow.
And got into the investing program. I think it was just an MBA program, maybe, whatever it was back then. But yeah, he studied under Graham and then kind of devoured his principles. And Graham ran a investment partnership on the side as well as teaching. It was one of the first kind of hedge funds in the field of finance. So back in the 1920s and 30s, it started up. And Buffett kind of like pestered him and for years and years to go and work for him, and then ended up getting a job. And that was kind of like where he honed his skills. But even to this day, you can see the influence of Graham on the way he, you know, the way he invests and the way he thinks.
Are there any other people that you're aware of, like Benjamin Graham today, who, like, I guess, who have an academic background but still do trading or have a very active sort of business kind of model on the side that you're aware of?
That's a good question. There's definitely a lot more academics, you know, that focus on value investing because, like, the interesting thing about Graham is that not only was he, like, a pioneer in investing theory, but very few academics for many years afterwards didn't even pay lip service to his ideas. Mm. Like, even though they became like standard practice among professionals gradually, like Buffett and Munger and these guys were kind of like the very early adopters. But it's taken years, and even now there's only like two or three business schools, I think, in the world that actually have a dedicated value investing program which tries to, you know, pull Graham's ideas into a modern context. Like the Columbia Business School is one, and there's a couple of academics there who I think there's just purely academics, but they do get a lot of professionals in there as well. But yeah, it'd be hard to find someone. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head today who's like as prominent as an academic as an investor as well. the closest maybe would be a guy called Jim Grant.
Oh, yeah.
Who's a financial, he's kind of like Graham in the sense that he's an author, he's a writer. Like Graham was known for his love of like literary classics, and like I think he was actually meant to be a teacher in philosophy as and literature as well as finance. Like he was just such a broad intellect and interested in all sorts of things and just a very unique mind. Jim Grant's a bit like that. Like I think he sees investing as kind of like an art, and that's why he keeps interested. And he writes a lot of books of about investors and financial markets, as well as practicing on the side. And his financial publication, Grant's Interest Rate Observer, is kind of seen as like the gold standard for investment writing today. So
yeah, right. That's super interesting, because and you know, that's another, you know, it's another interesting point about the value investing not being sort of taken seriously in an academic sort of discipline or setting.
I mean, have you heard of the efficient markets theory? Have you heard of that?
Oh, yeah, it rings a bell, but I wouldn't be an expert in it.
Well, so to give you a really small pricey, like the whole idea about efficient market theory is that you can't beat the stock market because there's that many people operating within it that prices converge to value. And so there's no point trying to be a professional stock picker. And the efficient market theory tried to explain people like Buffett as outliers. It's like, well, if you grabbed, you know, 300,000 chimps and got them all to flip a coin, eventually you're going to end up with one chimp that looks like he's pretty special because just from the sheer number, you know, sheer way that chance works. And this was actually, this was a prominent academic actually said this in like the 80s and 90s, I think it was, about Buffett. And he came out and wrote an article called, The Super Investors of Graham and Doddsville. And what he did was he grabbed a whole bunch of successful investors, including himself and guys like Benjamin Graham and Charlie Munger and a few others. And he, you know, pointed out their records, you know, that they trounced the market by huge percentages for a number of years. And he said, you know, that the mathematics of, you know, coin flipping monkeys does make sense, but if you went through the exercise and you got down to 10 monkeys and they were all in the same zoo, you know, you'd want to find out what they were eating. And he's like, that's kind of what happened with these super investors. He's like, they were all drinking the same Kool-Aid. They were all reading Graham's books and applying the same principles. So they kind of were a living example that markets aren't efficient and there are opportunities to beat the market. But yeah, financial theory at academic level pretty much said that you couldn't beat the markets for, you know, for the life of you. So just don't try. It's more recently that's been challenged.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. And I mean, obviously everyone wants to learn from Buffett on how to beat the market. That's, you know, like how to invest well, what value you ought to look for in terms of value. And obviously there's a financial side to that, but maybe just a bit back on the character sort of side of things, like having the right temperament, and some of those things that Buffett's sort of known for. Maybe just what are some of the sort of non-financial tips to investing, I guess, if you know what I mean, that he kind of emphasizes or talks about? It's the broader life lessons to, rather than just sort of being able to value invest or pick good stocks or companies.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that he has become renowned for, and I think one of his secret ingredients in a way, is his personal discipline. So in another way, it's his temperament. Like he has a common saying about how you don't need to have a high IQ to be a good investor. He's like, you need to have a certain temperament. And the reason is that it's more about, in order to beat the market, you need to wait for opportunities where prices are lower than intrinsic value. That's essentially the Graham investing style in a nutshell. You want to buy 50 cents for, you want to buy a dollar for 50 cents kind of thing. And in order to do that, because markets are two-sided, you're trying to, you know, someone's selling you that stock, which you think is cheap. So they have to, you know, they have to be wrong in their analysis. And usually that only happens when people are freaking out or there's a panic or, you know, they've missed something. So he's like, those opportunities don't come around very often. And more often than not, people, you know, people are going crazy en masse. So you have to keep your head about you when everyone else is losing theirs. Yeah. And so temperament is a huge thing, and combine that with patience. He's like, most professional investors are, you know, they'll do a lot of the work, they'll analyze a company's balance sheet, do all the industry work and get a feel for what they think a company's like. But then after they've done that work, they feel like they have to go and buy it anyway, because there's a kind of like a commitment bias. It's like, you want to come forward for all the work you've put in. And he's like, investing is a different art form, in the sense that you can do all that work, but you need to wait for the price to be appropriate to compensate you for the risk you're taking on. Mm. And that sort of that patience, extreme patience in a way, is what's made him so good. So it's, yeah, not everyone has that temperament to kind of really just sit in their thumbs for a long time.
Yeah, I know that commitment bias in particular is something that apparently even like with deposits, there's some science to it, where people obviously like think, well, you know, if I've made a 10% deposit on, say, a boat or a car, that, you know, they're obliged to go through with the deal, like, you know, to pay the full price and go through with the deal. Whereas it's like, you know, a deposit's there to sort of, so that you can walk away as well, I suppose. Yeah. That's interesting about temperament.
Another one, like on that front, is like, you know, if you're in a movie and you're 15 minutes in and you already hate it, it's like, you don't stay to find out what happened. You just leave, because the opportunity cost of your time is more valuable. But that's like, you know, the sunk cost bias of wanting to go through what you've already started. And that's really common in investing. But it's funny, because these things, there's a reason why that bias exists, because it's like, that's what creates loyalty. Like, can you imagine if everyone was like 10% into their marriage and then they're like, I'm done here. It's like, there's a reason why we have these commitment biases.
Yeah, fair point. That's really... Yeah. So one of the things I think that Buffett also is well known for, and I touched on this before, is about, you know, again, this is now moving in away from the sort of character type thing, and there's the ideas of temperament, to like picking stocks that make sense. Like, how do you do, like, how would you break it down, say, for someone who's an informed listener, about getting, you know, buying that dollar for 50 cents? Like, how would Buffett buy a dollar for 50 cents?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, because his approach has kind of evolved over his investing lifetime. And that in itself is really important, because it shows that, you know, he's a learning machine. It's like, if he was still investing the way he was back in the 1960s today, it's like, he wouldn't be doing as well. It's like, he's continually had to improve and adapt his system based on, you know, the nature of markets today, and like the scale that he's dealing with. Like, Berkshire now has, I think it's $700 billion worth of assets, $350 billion worth of equity. It's like, things don't scale up in a certain way. So he's had to change and evolve. And so back in the old days, his style of investing, he would have described it as cigar butt. It's cigar butt investing. And this is the whole, what you're saying, buying $1.50. And the logic behind it is that if you walk along and you see a cigar butt on the ground, but there's one puff in it, you pick it up, you get your puff and you move on. And it's ugly, but you know you're guaranteed to get your puff. And you know, he would just keep going along and picking up these cigar butts and milking those returns. So, you know, that's kind of what the Graham style was about. It was like looking at an asset and trying to really, really delve into what the liquidation value was. So he'd try and figure out, you know, the worst possible scenario for a company, and then buy it for less than that value. And back when Graham started investing, you know, it was in the Great Depression. So you had a lot of companies that were selling for less than the cash on their balance sheet, which is just crazy. Like, you wouldn't see that today, but that was just the nature of the times. But when Buffett was coming through in the 50s and 60s, markets were still very inefficient, in the sense that you could get whole businesses trading at well below their intrinsic value. And that was what he described as cigar butt investing. And so it's very much focused on low quality companies with hard assets. Think like oil refineries, textile mills, which is what Berkshire was originally. So he hopped around and he looked for these, 50 cents on the dollar type situations and went from one to the other. And yeah, back then that meant he was making 30% on his money a year or more. It was, yeah, crazy returns. Mm. So, but over time, that system doesn't scale very well because it's very hard to get to, you know, multi-billion dollar companies which are selling for less than the cash on their balance sheet. It just doesn't happen because there's too many people looking at the company. Mm. So he evolved from, cigar butt investing to what I would call franchise investing. And a key part of that was his partnership with Charlie Munger. And you talk about role models. Mm. I think Munger, also a unsung hero of Buffett's story. Like, everyone knows he's his partner, but he's also a role model in the sense that he helped Warren sort of evolve his investing style away from low quality to high quality companies. And the perfect example is something like Coca-Cola. And Coca-Cola is not like, it's not capital intensive. They, you know, essentially the way the Coke business works is that they have a certain syrup which goes into the, let's just take Coca-Cola itself, not all the other products that they have, but they have a syrup which they sell to bottling companies and they get a royalty on whatever thing is sold. That's a really oversimplified form of how the Coke business works, but it's like, you know, they don't manufacture anything themselves. They, you know, they don't need to invest to grow operations. They really just need to, they have this wonderful brand which they just keep milking as people, you know, devour their products. So that the power there is not in the hard asset value. It's not in like plant and equipment or anything like that. It's in this intangible brand and consumer. Yeah, Munger kind of made him realize, is like, you don't necessarily need to buy low quality companies for 50 cents on the dollar. You can pay a fair price for a really high quality company and hold it forever. And that was what he's kind of drifted towards over time.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a good, like, I like how you framed it up in terms of how he's someone who's constantly learned. Like, he couldn't be investing how he would have invested, you know, 1960 today. And, you know, it shows that he's had to voraciously sort of reinvent how he, you know, his approach and all the things that he learns. And, you know, that's done through voracious reading. I mentioned before about how he read every book in the library. I mean, you know, one of the things he apparently enjoys doing is reading Moody's manuals. I took a little note down here, but they're, you know, 8,000 pages each or something like that. You know, and his idea of fun is analyzing securities and flicking through these manuals for someone who wouldn't know what's in them. What joy do you get out of, what would you find in there, and what sort of joy would Buffett get out of those?
For him, it'd be like reading porn. He would just
well, he actually coughing. Says that, you know, for most other people, they get subscriptions to Playboy, while, you know, he was the guy getting subscriptions to Moody's, like, back in the day, like
Yeah, so there's you might have seen the documentary that was done about him on HBO a couple of years ago, and they actually go to his office and you know, they're looking at his bookshelf, and he pulls out one of these Moody's manuals from the 1950s, and he starts flicking through it, and they're like, "Is this like going through family photo albums?" And he's like, "Better." And you're like, "Geez, I hope his kids weren't watching that." going through the Moody's manual was kind of like, that was what he was doing back in the early days. He would be going through every single company that was listed in America and trying to see whether or not it was trading below what he would have considered its liquidation value. And that's a quantitative type analysis. It's like, you know, he's going through what's the inventories, what's the cash, how much debt does it have, and kind of, you know, figuring out the worst case scenario, which is the company goes bankrupt. Yeah. And if it's selling less for its bankruptcy value, then, you know, it's money for jam. So that was his approach. And you think about it, he's doing this in the 50s and 60s. It's like, you know, computers aren't really around. It was like he was essentially doing what gets done by screens today. Mm. Like, you can log into your NabTrade account or whatever and do that same type of screen that he was doing manually all those years ago. But it was like pure grunt force. That was how he was operating.
Yeah, pretty impressive stuff, because I was about to say that, you know, you could get a computer to do that. So there's obviously a strong human element to what he's done, and now he's sort of adapted himself.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the, you know, moving to higher quality companies where you're now dealing with intangibles. It's, you know, they, that type of stuff can't be done by a computer. They're trying to, they're like, if you look at Munger's speeches and body of work, you understand that he spends most of his time like learning about human behavior and, yeah, trying to get into the more intangible aspects of the way the world works. So it's a different approach. But one of the things I think is worth pointing out is that most people look at Buffett and they just think about his investing, and they don't realize that Berkshire Hathaway is actually a much more complicated enterprise. And he's not just sitting there picking stocks like some random fund manager. Berkshire is actually one of the largest insurance companies in the world, and he's not only you know, the money he's investing is what he would call float from the insurance business. So if you think of an insurance company where it's like you want to go get life insurance, you'll pay your annual premiums, and then, you know, if an accident happens, you know, your partner goes and makes a claim. Berkshire writes those types of insurance policies, but more to do with like property casualty around, you know, like around, you know, home and contents or you know, automobile insurance. So they take in all these premiums and then pay out claims later. And in the meantime, they invest the money they have. And he invests that money in companies like Coca-Cola and, you know, Apple and all these businesses. Mm. And then, yeah, it's a much more nuanced enterprise than just, you know, sitting at home picking stocks.
Yeah, fair enough. And you've been to a Berkshire Hathaway annual conference, haven't you?
Yeah, I went, what was it, 4 years ago now? So I went to the 50th anniversary meeting, which was, yeah, wow. It was kind of like it was 50 years since Buffett took over Berkshire Hathaway. And yeah, it was, this was before they actually, you know, broadcast the meetings live. So it was a pretty, pretty special.
And I guess, I remember you saying there, because I imagine there'd be all of these businesses that are connected to Berkshire Hathaway are represented there. Is that right? Like they've got a, you know, a pack down Walmart and stuff like that, and a few other, like, it's a quite an impressive setup, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, so they book out this whole convention center, and the year I was there, there was something like 40,000 people. It was ridiculous. Mm. And the average age is like 55 or something, so it was pretty funny seeing all these geriatrics walking around, and yeah, they're loving it. But what happens is that all these companies set up stores, and the shareholders get like discount shopping rates, and you know, for some of them, you just get to talk to the company management and learn about what they're doing. And then yeah, Buffett and Munger take Q&A for 6 hours, and yeah, it's a pretty, I can't think of any event in the business world like it. It's yeah, really, really rare to see people not only that enthusiastic about a company, but to just, yeah, be in the spirit of capitalism in a way like that.
Sure. And I recall as well, one of the biggest lessons you've learned from Buffett is like that sort of true essence of capitalism, about capitalism being business and business being capitalism. Is that something that, maybe expand a bit on that, about what you've learned from him specifically?
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes of his is, I'm a better investor because I'm a businessman, and a better businessman because I'm an investor. Mm. And this is kind of why I was hinting at the point that he's not just sitting there picking stocks like a typical fund manager that you think of. He's running a world-class business, a world-class insurance operation, and you know, they own a number of companies outright, not just passive stock holdings. So he's not only, you know, he not only invests, he's a business manager too. And I don't think people pay enough attention to that. It's like the skill set, one and the same. It's like most managers today don't have a great understanding of capital allocation. And you'll see a lot of CEOs who will make terrible acquisitions or throw good money after bad. And they might have come up through the ranks and be really good salesmen and or maybe good on the operation side, but when it comes to capital allocation, they suck at it. And then on the other hand, there's a lot of investors, a lot of fund managers who, they might understand the broad ideas of allocating capital, but the nuts and bolts of how businesses work. So that's one of the things I've really pulled away from his philosophy.
And you sort of get the sense where he would have to have good people around him advising him. You know, you've got Charlie Munger there. Who's the other guy that he talked about who's on the board, who he might take over? You know, then there were, if he had to save Charlie and, is it Ajit?
Yes, Ajit, yeah. He used to say if Ajit, him and Charlie were drowning, save Ajit.
Yeah.
So, and Ajit's story is pretty interesting. So he came to Berkshire in the mid-80s, and I don't know who introduced him to Buffett, but he had no experience in insurance, and he somehow got on Buffett's side, and Buffett entrusted him to set up a reinsurance operation. And reinsurance is essentially the business of insuring other insurance companies. And they carved out a niche insuring some of the largest like catastrophe risks in the world. So like whenever a large hurricane hit the States or Australia, Berkshire was potentially at a loss for that natural disaster. And the reason why they got into that business is because there's not very much data on it. It's not a traditionally quantitative insurance business like, say, automobile crashes or life insurance. It's got much larger sums and much harder to predict. And you need to have a certain temperament and discipline about pricing that risk. And Ajit pretty much turned that into the largest reinsurance operation in the world. And that's why they're like, if you want to save anyone, save him, because he's made more money for Berkshire than almost anyone else. And that's a perfect example, I think, of how the investing prowess of Buffett kind of gets overrated, and the broader stuff going on with Berkshire is underrated.
Yeah, fair enough. And I think, on the point about having good people like Ajit around and Charlie Munger, I have heard Buffett say at the same time that, you know, his idea of a focus group or a group of advisors is actually just looking in the mirror. And, you know, I think, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, well, he's got a board of directors like every other company, but he would, you know, he would do his own thing.
Go like, rogue like this podcast.
Yeah. Like he talks to Munger about every stock idea. I mean, most stock ideas probably. Like they have, although I think they're at the stage now where they pretty much know what each other is going to say. So they will back and forth certain ideas, but in the end, Warren's there to make the call. And the board of directors is really just people I think that he loves and admires. And it's like a big cult, really.
Yeah.
And they even call it a cult.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, though, Sean, have you ever watched any of the, because all the annual meetings now, like the Q&A sessions are online, and obviously the letters to shareholders are available. Have you ever read any of those or watched those videos?
Only a few videos. And as I mentioned, I've watched a few of the sort of motivational type things where it's a distillation of Buffett's kind of advice, but more on character and those sorts of things. I've read a couple of books where he cited a fair bit about you know, different tips and strategies. Seen that HBO documentary, but in terms of actual the Q&A, like a full session, no, I haven't. And I don't think, maybe I've only read one or two of the letters, but with those, maybe actually that'll be a good thing for listeners to sort of get an idea of. How does he write these letters to shareholders, and how many of them have you read?
Over 50 now, and I haven't read all of them. I started from the beginning and then got to about the mid-90s and then got distracted, and then I more recently worked my way backwards from 2018 and got to, I think, 2005. So there's about a 10-year gap in there which I haven't covered.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's been writing these letters with his sisters in mind. So he's got an older sister and a younger sister, and they're enormous shareholders of Berkshire. And I think he's picked them because he sees them as intelligent people that don't have a business background, But so his challenge is to explain the way the business works in the most simple terms. And I think if you wanted to get a business education, those letters are the best thing you can possibly find for that exact reason. It's like, it's not like a usual textbook where everything's coked in jargon and mathematic formulas. He just breaks things down into their utmost simplicity. And that's because he knows it so well. Like you would understand this, like the better you know an idea, the better you understand the topic, the more simple you can be in your language, the more concise you can be. So
yeah, definitely. Well, what about Jordan? So there's some stuff, you know, we've talked about how good Buffett is, and obviously he's very, you know, he's had a lot of successes. What about some sort of, like, has he had any big failures that you're aware of? Or I know that, you know, one of the things he talks about is like, if you hit hurdles or you make mistakes, and he said he's made a lot, it might not seem like it, but his advice is to keep moving, and he's a character that doesn't seem to dwell on mistakes. And I know one of the things as well that he said is that when he has, you know, the biggest mistakes he's made are the things that he's known are mistakes. It's kind of easy when you're ignorant about things, but those are sort of some of the regrets that he's had, where he's sat on his hands or known he should have done something or made an investing decision or a business decision, but he knew he should have done otherwise. And again, it's easier to be ignorant about that because you know, you don't know what you don't know. But for someone like that, knowing what you, you know, knowing what you don't know, or and vice versa, is there any insight in there about approaching failure, or, you know, any mistakes that he's made that you think are worth touching on?
Yeah, well, do you want personal or business?
Oh, both.
I think reading the biography, one of the things that stands out is his relationship with his family. I think anyone who's as successful as he is, like, they have a certain level of intensity and single-mindedness, which means that they sacrifice a lot. And I think he would readily admit, and this is what came away from reading the book, is that he sort of neglected his children to an extent. Like, he outsourced the parenting to his wife for a large degree. And I think his marriage suffered a bit as well. So he actually, he never got divorced, but his wife moved away, oh, would it have been in the 70s or 80s? I think about the time he was 50 that, yeah, she ended up moving to San Francisco once the kids had grown up and started leading her own life. And that devastated him. Mm. Like, I think he was completely shocked. And you get the sense that he's quite a sensitive guy. Mm. He makes a lot of effort to make sure people like him. And that, you know, that, and he's done very well at that. Like, his jovial sort of folksy attitude is what's got him there. But yeah, I think he was so intensely focused on achieving his business goals that he neglected that personal side of his life. And I think he spent a lot of the last couple of decades trying to make up for that. So that's probably one side. An interesting thing actually on that front is that after his wife moved away, she was so worried about him not being able to survive because the guy didn't know how to cook or look after him. So she ended up asking one of her friends to look after him. And, you know, she kind of lived with Buffett for the next decade or so, and they ended up becoming intimate, or I don't know, intimate, but like they ended up being together. Mm. And yeah, his first wife was completely supportive of it. So in a way, Buffett for a number of years had like two women in his life. So yeah, that's a bit strange. And but then after his first wife passed away from cancer, I think over a decade ago now, he ended up marrying this other lady, Astrid, I think her name is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, after that. So it's funny how some people's lives turn out.
Sure.
Anyway, that's probably a mistake on the personal front. But on the business front, there's a number of business failures that he would happily point out. And the most obvious one is Berkshire itself. So Berkshire is a textile mill. Or Berkshire Hathaway was a textile mill, out in the eastern states. And it was one of these classic cigar butt investments. Buffett bought it for like less than its liquidation value. And he was just trying to milk that last puff out of the cigar. And it ended up, he was going to exit the position where through a buyback from the company. The company were going to tender for his shares, and he negotiated with the manager at the time at a certain price, And he's like, okay, I've got this locked in. I'll be out of here and onto my next thing. And then when the offer came through, it was like 50 cents less than what they'd agreed. And he was so pissed off. He's like, no way, I'm not doing this. This guy's trying to screw me. And he ended up doubling down and buying more to the extent where he could actually fire the manager and take control. Uh-huh. And one of the rare moments where Buffett's like temperament kind of cracked. Mm. And this is probably why at the same time his father actually passed away. So I think that was, yeah, kind of bittersweet how these things work out. Like that emotional turmoil in his life. But he would readily admit that one of his worst decisions was buying that textile mill, because it ended up like, you know, destroying capital for a number of years. And his job after that was redirecting the limited cash flow from that textile mill into other enterprises. So that's one business failure. Another one which you know, sort of like defined his career in a way, was an investment in Salomon Brothers. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, yep.
So, you know Michael Lewis's book, Liar's Poker?
Sure.
Yeah, did you ever read that?
No, but I know I think you're going to talk about Moneyball, but I know the book.
So the story is like that book put him on the map, and it was pretty much him talking about his experience in this investment bank, and it was like all the crazy stuff was going on, and it kind of like became like the defining book of that era for like excess and greed on Wall Street. Well, at the same time, Buffett was taking a big stake in Salomon Brothers.
Mm.
And yeah, it was kind of a weird event because he'd spend most of his time like hanging shit on most investment bankers and the fact that, you know, they put themselves ahead of their clients and stuff like that. And yeah, he ended up taking this big stake and it blew up on him. One of the traders ended up rigging treasury auctions a couple of times. Mm. And they didn't tell the government, and the government at one point threatened to cut them off from the US bond market. And as an investment bank, that's your bread and butter business. So I think it was one of the biggest institutions on Wall Street at the time. And if the government had cut it off, it would have been like Lehman Brothers. It would have been, you know, it would have been a massive event. And he ended up firing the CEO and going in as CEO himself to try and rectify the company and get the government's faith. And he was very close to overseeing like a financial calamity. But I think at the same time, if it wasn't for the integrity and reputation he had, that Salomon Brothers wouldn't have got out of it. Mm. I mean, you've probably seen some of the stories about Dick Fold at Lehman Brothers and how he was just an asshole and full of, you know, it was really arrogant. And I think that's half the reason why, you know, Lehman Brothers didn't get saved, because no one wanted to give Dick Fold any money for it, you know, his attitude. that's kind of a testament to Buffett. Even like a really terrible investment like that, he still managed to kind of salvage in a way. Mm. But just one last one, probably the biggest mistakes that he would admit to are actually what he would describe as acts of omission. It's the companies that they've missed. Mm. It's like, kind of like, you know, the idea of opportunity costs. It's not necessarily the direct cost of your time. It's what you could have been doing with your time if you weren't sitting in that movie you wanted to leave. Mm. And like he would list stuff like Google. I mean, him and Charlie have said that they should have seen that from a mile away. It's like their insurance companies were using Google, was becoming a dominating, a dominant part of their advertising, and they should have just been able to, you know, jump on that way early on. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Big gap miss, but lots to fill the place, I think. Well, Jordan, and is there any... I mean, one of the things I think that we touched on at the start was about things that jumped out, and one of the things I forgot to mention was he gives a great analogy when he spoke to school kids, and I presume he speaks to them a fair bit, but there's this one clip I was watching where, you know, he talks about, you know, being able to treat yourself, you know, imagine if you only have one car for the rest of your life, and what would you do with it? It's like, well, you'd make sure you treat it well, you know, you change the oil, check the tires, make sure it's clean regularly. And he's like, well, you've only got one body, and you're only yourself for the rest of your life, so you better take good care of yourself. I remember that was a really good analogy about, you know, like being able to look after yourself, you know, work on yourself, but kind of be in it for the long haul and a bit of a marathon and not a sprint. And I thought that was really useful advice that certainly has stuck with me. Are there any other parting bits of wisdom for, you know, from Buffett that you've learnt that you kind of distilled down, and you touched on a few of them here, but what else do you think is worth?
That is a great one. I remember that one as well. Have you heard of his punch card analogy?
No, oh, no, I don't think so.
Okay, so he talks about one of the biggest problems for investors is like the cost of churn. It's like the biggest, one of the biggest issues is that people feel the need to act, kind of getting back to this idea of patience and discipline. It's like one of the things that really destroys your investment returns is constantly moving in and out of positions, and you pay more in taxes and brokerage costs. And he's like, you really need to be focused on the long term. And that's kind of, you know, the science behind index funds and Jack Bogle's, contributions.
Yeah.
But he says for an active investor, so an active investor is obviously not going to be holding an index fund, but, you know, to try and stick to this this idea of long-term investing, he's like, you should imagine that you've got a punch card in your hand, and every time you make an investment, you have to punch a hole in that card. And there are only 20 potential holes in that punch card, and you get that for your entire life. And he's like, if you only make 20 investments in your entire lifetime, you would think way more deeply about the investments you're making, whether or not you're operating within your circle of understanding, all these types of things that you should be doing. But, you know, when the noise of the market and the day is going on, you kind of lose track. So I think that's a really good one. Another one is the science of hitting. He loves his baseball analogies. Have you heard of this one?
No.
So I can't remember which baseball player it was. It was like one of the guys who had the highest batting averages in history. But he says that he read this guy's book, and it talked about this guy would only swing if it was in his sweet spot. Mm. And he's like, this baseball player drew a grid of all the potential areas that a ball would come out in. And he's like, this little square in all this, you know, large grid, he's like, this little square is where I'll hit. He's like, anything out of that square, I'm going to ignore. It's like, I'll either get a strike or it'll go through to the keeper. And he's like, investing is exactly like baseball, except there's no strikes. And you can define your little square of what falls right in your sweet spot. And you can stand there all day and everyone can be yelling at you saying, swing, you bum. But you don't have to, you don't have to hit unless it's in your sweet spot. And I think... that idea of, he would call it your circle of competence, is probably for me his greatest sort of contribution. So Benjamin Graham was known for his phrase was margin of safety. He's like, that's where the idea of cigar butts came from. Buying 50 cents on the dollar is you're buying something for less than it's worth, so you've got that margin of safety built into your investment. Buffett's shift towards quality companies means that you're dealing with stuff that's way more uncertain. You're dealing with a future, you know, the future likelihood of cash flows. And so when you're dealing with that type of stuff, you're really trying to make a intelligent analysis of the future. And so the ability for you to understand the future, completely or better than others, you need to be operated within your circle of competence. So That I think is a really powerful idea that investors should keep in mind.
Sure, and that punch card analogy is very, very good. I think about it's very similar to the car analogy, but in a business sense. And I'd definitely like to have you on for a whole other episode to talk more about Buffett, but also what your circle of competence is. I'd be very interested to know what your sweet spot is and how you've managed to refine that and whittle that down over the years and years of reading that you've been doing.
Yeah, well, I'm sad to say it's not bigger than, you know, that I'd like it to be. It's too small given how much reading I've done. But anyway, this is my own. Mate, I was going to ask you, I mean, we've talked about Buffett a lot, but Munger is kind of, as I mentioned, he's like the unsung hero. How much do you know of him, and like, does he Has he come across your radar a lot?
Not a whole heap, and never really by himself. It's always, you know, as an addendum to Buffett. And, you know, if anything, when you watch Buffett or read him, you know, he always mentions Charlie Munger. But he's sort of a figure that, yeah, he's not very prominent, I don't think, in terms of someone like myself who's not reading, you know, like not aware of, you know, reading investing stuff all the time, who he is, what his sort of story is. He very much seems as an addendum to Buffett, versus sort of his own kind of character, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, for me, one of the biggest surprises, like going down this journey of learning about Berkshire and Buffett, is that I've actually come away having more respect and admiration for Charlie Munger, which is...
I think that's what Buffett... It sort of seems that that's kind of what is, like, that's the truth, like, because he's like... Buffett always points to him to go, like, look, I'm not the man. This guy's the man. Like, and he credits him like every step of the way, it seems.
Yeah, and if you watch the annual meeting videos, maybe not the more recent ones, because Charlie's 96 or whatever, so he's starting to, you know, really slow down. But if you go back to the videos in the early 90s and watch the two of them, it's pretty awesome because Buffett's firing. Like he looks young compared to today. He's in his 60s. He's just like bang, bang, bang. And then Charlie's just in his prime. And you get a sense that Charlie's a much broader thinker. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. I think that's what I found appealing about him. He started as a lawyer and then moved into investment management. And then, you know, he's just got he does things like he's an architect in like his spare time. Mm-hmm. So, and he's on, you know, a hospital foundation and things like that. So he's got a much different view of life. And he's also, I think he's had a harder time. Like if you go through Buffett's history, it's kind of like things worked out pretty well for him very early on. Like he was a pretty lucky guy, upper middle class family. His father was a congressman. Mm-hmm. Munger went through a much harder, he got dealt a much harder set of cards. Mm-hmm. Like his first son died of leukemia, mm-hmm. like at a young age. Mm-hmm. He got divorced in his, I think, his late 20s. He more recently had botched eye surgery where he went blind in one eye. Like really an unsung hero, and his way of thinking about the world is much, much deeper and useful. And I think if more than even Berkshire's letters to shareholders, if I was to recommend one book to people, it'd be Poor Charlie's Almanac, which is a collection of Munger's speeches and essays throughout his life. It's absolutely epic.
Yeah, so, excellent. Well, I'll drop that in the show notes. I think maybe for the next episode or a future one, we do one on Munger. Maybe that's a good way to. I'm sure you could glean as much knowledge on him as Buffett from you.
Yeah, I could talk hours about him as well.
Oh, well, brilliant. But I think that sort of exhausts time, Jordan. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on very briefly? I would love listeners to get in touch with you directly. Can they go to your website and if they've got any questions on Buffett?
Yeah, they can go to wigcapital.com or you'll find my email address on there, but it's jjshopov@wigcapital.com.
Awesome.
Definitely drop me a line. Love to chat about Berkshire.
Yep, definitely. And again, I think he's, you know, a character that's just really well known, but I think you've been able to illuminate listeners and even myself onto some of the less, you know, dive a bit more into the detail about who he is, what he's come from. And I think what's critical are some of the mistakes that he's made as well. And what I really liked was how you mentioned how he's evolved his thinking and really kept pace with the times.
Actually, yeah, if there's one big takeaway, it's this idea of being a learning machine. It's like you want to pull out a big lesson of his life. It's like never stop learning. That's what life is all about, continuous learning. Mm. So
yeah, and growth, good stuff. All right, well, Jordan, thanks very much for that. I'll put all that stuff in the show notes and then especially your contact details. But for listeners, please get in touch with Jordan directly. I'm sure I'd love to hear from you. And for any other podcasts, please come to seanjacobs.com.au and drop ideas for future podcasts, etc. But we hope you've enjoyed talking about Warren Buffett. Jordan Shropov, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks, mate.